Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A young child's brain is vulnerable to good and bad experiences. If a young child is loved and properly cared for, his or her brain usually develops in a very healthy manner and at an appropriate developmental pace. If a child is abused or neglected, especially repeatedly, that development can be stunted, leading to sometimes severe behavioral and emotional problems not easily fixed. Dr. Bruce Perry is known internationally for his work on the neurological effects of child abuse and neglect. He is a psychiatrist, author, founder, and senior fellow at the nonprofit Child Trauma Academy in Houston. He's been in town this week to address an event devoted to changing the cycle of child abuse and family violence. He's with us now in the studio, and we welcome you to the show.
Thank you very much.
Your work goes deep into understanding the origins of violence and aggression. First of all, you say that all violence is not the same. What are the distinctions that you're talking about there then?
Well, there are a lot of different ways in which a violent crime can take place. You know, one of the things that we see, and I think a lot of people will see this portrayed in the media, there might be a predatory, intentional effort to track an individual and then prey on that individual. That's one form of violence. The more common form of violence, actually, though, is impulsive. And that typically happens when somebody who is overly reactive is confronted in a way that frustrates them to the point that they will lash out at the person. And it may start out by an escalation of calling names, and then it leads to a push, and then it leads to fists, and then it leads to pulling a knife, and then it leads to pulling a gun. And if you look at particularly youth violence, a tremendous amount of it is related to this impulsivity and reactivity. So it's part of the challenge of trying to understand any human behavior is that there are lots of different routes to the exact same behavior. And if you don't deconstruct the route, you don't really understand the mechanism. And that means you're going to have a really hard time coming up with a good solution.
In other words, understanding the route to that behavior is what's going to help you understand the treatment for it.
Exactly.
You say that aggression is not violence, but it's the threat of violence, right? And can't that have a similar effect on a child?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, one of the interesting things about work that's being done on the impact of growing up in a home where there's domestic violence is that the exposure to the conflict, the tension, the anger, the climate, the emotional climate created in a domestic violence environment can change the brain. And in some ways it can change if it is more permeating, if it's present all the time in a child's home, that will have more impact, negative impact on that child than if that child was actually injured by being assaulted by a parent. So in other words, an actual physical violent act that occurs once in a rageful moment, but the rest of the time the child's home is generally not tense, it has less impact on the developing child than a climate of tension and anger and humiliation or degradation.
Repeatedly constant.
Exactly.
Over a course of time. We were just talking a couple days ago about gang violence in Chicago and how they're right now using social media to assert that. And I'm thinking about kids who maybe are growing up in a relatively happy household, but are also growing up in an incredibly violent and dysfunctional neighborhood.
Yeah.
And if that can have the same effect on her, is it really what we're talking about, just what's inside the house?
Part of what's important to think about in that example is the impact of the environment that the child spends their day in is going to be the major determinant of how they're functioning in that moment. Now, with that said, if you're a two-year-old child and you're in a loving, safe home in a violent community, the majority of your daily environment is in that home. But as soon as you become school age and the majority of your time is out of that home, you are going to be exposed to this tension and threat, and ultimately you will start to exhibit problems that are trauma-related, threat-related. And so even though that having a healthy home in an unhealthy community is in many ways inoculating, it's a little bit protective, mm-hmm. ultimately, if you spend enough time in that toxic environment, you're going to start to have trauma-related symptoms. Now, the opposite is true as well. So if you have a healthy community and you have a toxic home, what happens is you can have all kinds of problems, but you start to heal when you get into school. Having a safe, predictable school, having neighbors invested in your life, being part of a community of faith, all of those people will help you buffer the bad things in your home and help you get on a more resilient trajectory. And so when you look at the determinants of health for children, what you find is that the major predictors of how a child is physical, emotional, social health have to do with community health factors as opposed to family factors. Now, I'm not saying the family factors don't matter, but when you think about a 15-year-old child, they spent 4 years in the home and then they spent 11 years mostly out of the home.
My guest is Dr. Bruce Perry, psychiatrist, author, and founder and senior fellow at the nonprofit Child Trauma Academy in Houston. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Right, but when a child, isn't it between birth to 3 years old that right. the child's brain is most vulnerable? Again, it could be a good or a bad thing, but most vulnerable, most changeable?
Exactly. And this is one of the reasons that so many of our program and policy efforts are around trying to create safe, nurturing environments for young children and trying to help young parents with their fundamental needs around housing and food and give them some education and support about child development. And so you're absolutely right. However, there's this, if you think about it a little bit like a balance, that no matter how healthy you are, if the load of exposure to toxic stress is sufficient, you'll start to have some consequences. So we see this with healthy people that join the army and go and spend a year in Iraq and then a year in Afghanistan and then another year in Afghanistan. And even though they had 18 years of healthy life and lots of reasons to be pretty well regulated, they end up with post-traumatic stress disorder.
And they talk about children from certain households and certain neighborhoods as having post-traumatic stress disorder.
Exactly. That's exactly right. In fact, one of the things that's been very, very important in the last, really probably the most important epidemiological studies in the last 50 years are what are referred to as the ACE studies, Adverse Childhood Experience Studies. And a group from the CDC, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, working with Kaiser Permanente in California, looked at 17,000 adults and looked at their physical health, their mental health, their social health, and then looked at the number of adverse childhood experiences they had, things that could potentially have caused a trauma. And what they find is if you have adverse childhood experiences, you are going to have an increased risk for physical health problems, mental health problems, social problems, substance abuse problems. And in fact, if you have three or more of these adverse childhood experiences, your risk for heart disease and diabetes is increased 4 to 12 times more than the general population. And so the consequences of adversity and trauma during childhood lead not just to post-traumatic stress disorder, but to a cascade of issues that involve the brain and the body.
Right. We've known a lot of the correlatives for a long time.
Yeah.
But now we can actually look at the brain.
Right, exactly.
While a person is alive.
Yeah.
And see how it differs and see the patterns of differences in the brain. Can you tell us about what we know and what we're getting out of that now?
You're right. This is a very exciting time. When I was just starting my training as a research scientist, we had to look at the brain in indirect ways. So we would look at things like heart rate, or we'd look at hormones or metabolites of neurotransmitters in the spinal fluid. But now we can actually look at activity in the brain. We can look at the level of connectivity between two parts of the brain. We can look at the brain literally as it's doing certain tasks. And we've learned a lot of things. One of the most powerful things that we've learned is that children who are neglected will have significant abnormalities and underdevelopment of key parts of their brain. And again, this is not that surprising when you understand that the brain develops in a use-dependent way. Any part of the brain that is activated, anything that you do with repetition, will tend to increase the number of synapses and the functional capability of that part of the brain. One of the things that we also see is if children are exposed to unpredictable or chaotic stress, they end up having a set of systems in their brain that are involved in the stress response that are abnormally regulated. And because these systems distribute to every part of the brain, these children end up having problems with forming and maintaining relationships. They have problems with learning. They have problems with regulating their attention. And they have problems with fine motor control. So they end up with pervasive neurological and emotional, behavioral, and as I mentioned earlier, physical health problems.
But because of our knowledge of the brain and how we're learning about the brain now, we also know that the brain can change. We grew up, you and I both grew up thinking, that's it, that's all you have, that's you know, you're done now, and good luck. But it can change.
Absolutely. And the funny thing is, it's designed to change. You know, the human brain is filled with 100 million neurons. And neurons are literally specifically designed to be responsive to environmental input. They have these special, literally this incredible wide net of receptive components that are wanting to hear from the world. And based upon what they hear from the world, in their micro, you know, their microscopic world, they will change. And so in sharp contrast to what people used to think, the brain is always changing and it wants to change. And there are a number of important principles about neuroplasticity that we can take advantage of to both maintain health as you get older, but also to achieve health and heal if those systems have been poorly organized.
Even if it's happened when a child is very, very young, when they're most vulnerable?
Yes. And I say yes with a little qualification. The first thing I should say is that this field, the whole field of studying child development and the brains of children, is incredibly young. We have so much to learn. Many of the methods and techniques that help us answer these questions are very new and emerging. But with that said, what we know is that if you're able to target the right parts of the brain, even if they were impacted early in life, you can make those areas in the brain more functional. Now, you may not ultimately be able to make them as functional as they might have been had they not been exposed to these toxic experiences. But we are much more optimistic about the ability to help children heal than we used to be. And it's an exciting time in this field.
You're listening to Dr. Bruce Perry. He's an international expert, psychiatrist, author, founder, and senior fellow at the nonprofit Child Trauma Academy in Houston. We're talking about how abuse and even neglect affects a child's brain development. And coming up, we're going to talk about how the neuroscience of an abused child can be put into practice in the field of child protection. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about how abuse and even neglect affects a child's brain development. Still with us is Dr. Bruce Perry. He's an international expert on the topic. He's been in town this week talking about that. Joining us now to discuss how understanding the neuroscience of an abused child can be put into practice in the field of child protection is Jane Wide. She's executive director of the Franklin County Family and Children First Council. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Glad to be here.
The Child Trauma Academy, of which Dr. Perry is a founder and senior fellow, has put out a brief paper that, among other things, addresses the reason why government agencies should be involved in early childhood issues. You put these neuroemotional issues on par with infectious diseases, Dr. Perry.
I think, you know, what we need to understand is that early developmental experiences impact the functional health of the individual and ultimately, because of that, the culture. And so many, many years ago, we decided as a society that infectious diseases were causing so much death and morbidity that it was in the broader public's best interests that we have a widespread immunization policy. And it was widely debated. You know, it was felt, oh my gosh, you know, you're invading the privacy of the home. You're forcing people to do something they don't want to do necessarily. But it was decided in the public's best interest. It's a public health issue that for the health of the broader society, that it's best that we do immunizations. Now, if you actually look at the morbidity, the problems, and the premature death, and the cost to society from child abuse, it's in excess of $63 billion a year. And so it is in the best interests of our society that we engage in proactive, preventative policies like essentially the equivalent of inoculations in the area of child abuse and neglect. And if and we have those strategies. We know that if you have a high-quality early intervention program with at-risk families, that you can divert children out of the juvenile justice system, out of the child protective system, out of the healthcare system. And in fact, James Heckman got the Nobel Laureate in Economics in the year 2000 for showing that early childhood investment with high-risk kids has a $9 return on investment, which means every dollar spent on those high-quality programs returns to society by the time the child's 21 years old, $9. And so this is absolutely a public health issue.
Jane Wide, have you thought of your mission with the Franklin County Family and Children First Council as one of public health, or is that kind of a new concept in your field, at least?
Well, I think it is a relatively new concept, but I think you'll see more and more people in the social service realm thinking of approaching children and families with a really holistic, wide continuum perspective, which includes addressing the health issues as well as the social service issues as well as all of the other issues that impact a family. And so we're getting better at being comprehensive and working with each other and thinking of it as one total continuum that a family needs.
Because the imposition on the family at the level that you're operating at in all the different ways that child protective services agencies do has been debated much the same way as vaccinations and that kind of thing as an intrusion into the family.
Yeah, and I think traditionally that perhaps has been the perspective in at least many communities. What you'll find now, however, is much more emphasis on early intervention, prevention, of course, but when a professional in the community sees that a family is beginning to operate with a lot of stress, or if a family themselves say, this is really too difficult for us, we need some help, the different approach, at least in this community, is an alternative response to actual intervention, which might include placing a child in a foster home or other more punitive approaches. But you'll see more often services from children's services and other agencies coming in early, providing professionals and paraprofessionals to come actually into the home to try to help parents and families have a different way to relate and to avoid getting down the road so far in terms of dysfunction and stress that it requires more punitive approach.
That's a really gray era. That requires an incredibly fine touch to anticipate where there might be problems and get people to buy in to you being there and doing something about it.
It is. And I think it goes back to relationship, relationship, relationship. And the more we can invest in folks who are doing outreach, such as our organization, such as many of the faith-based organizations and private advocacy organizations, the more we can connect with parents and convince them that public services can be a partnership. It's not necessarily big government coming in to tell them what to do, but the more we can advocate to them that we're partners and they have a role in identifying what their issues are, what their needs are, and how we can help them do that, the more they trust us and the better the result is.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how abuse and even neglect affects a child's brain development. We've been talking about the complexity of the impact of abuse, aggression, and neglect on a young child. Bottom line, it's complicated. You told the Columbus Dispatch last spring that symptoms of chest pain might lead doctors to consider 400 possible conditions, but that most traumatized children receive just one of five diagnoses.
Yeah, one of the issues about the human brain is that it's incredibly complex. And we've talked a little bit about this earlier, that with our newer methodologies of looking at the brain and the emerging understanding of neuroscience, it's time for the field of psychiatry to move away from a descriptive diagnostic labeling model and move more towards a mechanism-based diagnostic model like the rest of medicine. And so, for example, as you said, the heart has 8, 9, 10 cell types. It has one major function to pump blood, but there are literally hundreds upon hundreds of physiological routes by which you can have compromise to the heart. And so when you have chest pain, you could have an infection, you could have a heart attack, you could have a mass that was pushing against the heart. And so we don't call people who have the symptom of chest pain, we don't say your diagnosis is chest pain. We say your diagnosis is whatever the physiological or pathophysiological mechanism is. But when children have attention problems, which could come from literally hundreds of thousands of genetic, epigenetic, physiological routes, we say you have attention deficit disorder. And so in mental health, we are lumping together a heterogeneous group of children. And if we use those diagnostic categories to do research, we end up just chasing our tail. And we're not ever going to really get any answers until we move away from that diagnostic model, which is happening, actually.
So, Gene Wide, from where you sit, how are assessment and treatment plans for children changing from formulaic and therefore often inappropriate? Is there anything on the ground you could tell us about where this is changing?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I would hold up as an example is what Children's Services is doing right now. They have a grant coming from the federal government that will begin their relationship with a family and with a child with a comprehensive assessment, which includes trauma that the child has experienced, challenges that the family is now under siege with, what their goals and what their aspirations are for their children and their family. And rather than coming in and making an observation as a professional, not knowing the important stuff that parents actually are going to prioritize and can tell you, this new approach is just going to change the way we then select services and provide access for families and how we intervene.
What's going to trigger these evaluations?
Every child coming into that intake process is going to receive, when this is fully activated, they'll start right now with the more severe trauma-related reports. But every child eventually will receive this comprehensive trauma-informed approach. And so anyone who contacts either by themselves or by referral will have access to this entirely different approach.
But Dr. Perry, are there even close to enough people to execute these, what we know from, you know, there's the caseworkers, there's the foster parents, there's the family, there's the teachers. These kids come in contact with, so there's the bullies in the, on the playground, there's there's so much. How do you, given the complexity, it can be almost overwhelming when you think about it. How do you train everybody to help a child?
Well, that's, you are identifying one of the core problems with this whole area, and that is that everybody who comes into contact with these families and children, number one, has the potential to help them, but number two, almost everybody who comes in contact with these families and children needs to have a body of knowledge about development and regulation that would make their efforts to help them more efficient and actually effective. And one of the things that happens right now, unfortunately, is that a lot of people who are working really hard to help these children, teachers, for example, or people in mental health settings, are working in ways that are unfortunately not helping, and then sometimes it's making it worse. And that's not because they're bad people, or it's just because their working paradigm is a little outdated. And so the federal government, a lot of guild organizations, you know, professional organizations are promoting the concept of creating trauma-informed programs and practices. And basically what that means is that the people who work with these children, whether you're an educator or a foster parent or a mental health worker, you should understand the fundamentals about how the brain works, about how trauma changes the brain, about what that means for how somebody will react when they interact with you. And it will change the way you interpret their behaviors. It'll change your strategies about trying to help them. And with knowledge, all of these people in the lives of the children and the families will actually be more effective, and ultimately that will lead to better outcomes. And in the settings where we've been able to build capacity and about trauma, the outcomes are in some ways so good that we are reluctant to even accept that this is not just an epiphenomenon. So we are cautiously optimistic that when you help an educator understand these children, you will have remarkably better outcomes. And we've seen this in about 15 schools that we work with. And in other mental health settings where these kids were just plateauing and not doing well, and when you give this core information to those mental health workers, they change the way they work.
You mean,
and the outcomes are better.
Telling them there's this part when you scan the brain of the child, you know what part of the brain is deficient or has been over, whatever the aspect is. You mean literally sharing that information with the educator and saying this is what we need to do to.
Well.
Is it that specific?
It can be sharing specific information about a specific child. But even before that, there's a core body of knowledge that's very easy to learn about how the brain works. And the fact is, that information would make you a better parent. It would make you a better supervisor in business. It would make you a better teacher. It would make you a better almost anything you do. And in fact, we have curricular content about these core principles of the brain that we've used with the FBI, with the juvenile justice system, child welfare, mental health, education. We've even put it into public schools. And so, and when you know this core content, and then when you're given some specifics about how this person is organized, you can be so much more effective in trying to help educate them or parent them or heal them.
Is educating the professionals in the field about this kind of, about this core content, is this part of what you're doing as well? Jane White, is this part of the plan too?
Absolutely. We've been able, over the course of the last several years, to train almost 2,000 people in the community on these basic core concepts. And the magic thing that's happening now is that we're hearing people who have heard that message share it with other people, and we're hearing it back. And so if we can get into a school system, and Westerville school system is a good example of that, we've been able to train 75 teachers who are now sharing their information with their teacher colleagues, with the social workers and nurses and all of those folks who are working with in that school system. And it really is a message that's simple enough to spread through the community, professional to professional to professional. And the really interesting thing that's happened this year is that the Ohio State University has hosted this year's conference. And so if we can get that message out through those departments, and the response that we've had has been amazing. And wouldn't it be wonderful if every student who graduated and became a professional this year knew that message, and the year after that, and the year after that. So it's amazing how quickly that core information can spread. And then you have teams of people. Everyone who relates with that child is understands the same thing, is talking the same language, can provide the same kind of approach.
We are talking about child abuse, what it means physiologically, and how that knowledge, that neurophysiological knowledge we have now, can change how we address and remediate the effects of child abuse and child neglect. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the impact of child abuse, child neglect, and what we can do about it going forward with new information we have about how the brain works and how the brain can change. And brain plasticity has been a big issue in recent years. If you have a question or comment for my guest, Dr. Bruce Perry, he's an international expert on these issues, and also Jane Wide, she's from the Franklin County Family and Children First Council, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You said, Dr. Perry, that in order to understand an individual, one needs to know his or her history, and I was wondering how that works with a young child. You know, having just interviewed a junior high kid, they're like monosyllabic in their answers, and I wonder, how do you really get the history of a child, and how do you believe what their parents are saying? They may be the perpetrators. How do you really get that history?
Well, what you're pointing out really important points about the challenge of creating a reconstruction of a child's history. And one of the things that's important is, and we mentioned it a little bit earlier, that in some ways, if we were trying to reconstruct the history that was neurobiologically meaningful, it really wouldn't matter what the parent called the child. it would just matter the tone of how that interaction took place. So it seems like it would be complicated. And if you rely upon a completely verbal narrative, linear narrative, it is, you're just never going to get an accurate reconstruction. But if you look at the quality of the interaction and you use multiple historians and you have an opportunity to review some of the records, you can do a pretty good reconstruction of the general developmental climate. And that's more what is interesting for the development of the brain.
This has been an issue before, Jane White, but how much are foster parents allowed to know about their foster children and their backgrounds? How much are teachers allowed to know about what's really going on with some of their students? It seems to me not very much in the past.
Well, I think you're right. I think historically, when you removed a child from the home, there was a break between what was happening with the family of origin and the foster family. I think that perspective is changing. And the intent, the minute a child, it's determined that they're needed to be placed in a foster family, the intent is to get them home again. And so as much as possible, the charge of the agency is to develop the relationship between the foster parent and the bio parent so that they can work collectively and together on child behaviors and family functioning. And in many ways, without that knowledge from the parent, what's going on, the foster parent can't foster properly, nor can the foster parent respond to the child's needs without that communication and that background.
So you think this might be happening more organically as you bring the foster parents and the parents together and make them
Absolutely.
A team?
Absolutely.
But it's not,
yeah.
Okay.
And the team issue, again, is the point. The parent in the best systems is still the driver of what happens to the child. Now, that happens within some safety regulations and some guidance. But the parent has to feel like they are the partner and they're basically the captain of the ship in order to get them prepared to bring that child back home successfully.
Tammy and Carol, you're on the air. Welcome.
Calling because I have my husband and I adopted three children as a sibling group. Over 14 years ago, and they are now 19, 20, and 21, and they have some significant issues going into adulthood that our other, we have three biological children also, that those children do not have. And as a parent, I know you've been talking about educators and foster parents, and but this is a parental issue also. We had zero information about what neglect would have done to our kids. They were severely neglected and then pulled out of their home and placed in foster care for about 21 months before we got them at ages 7, 6, and 5. And so now they are trying to navigate adulthood, and it couldn't be tougher because emotionally they are probably 12, 11, and 10.
Which you talk about a lot, Dr. Perry.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, they were lucky to have you, and I suspect that you feel lucky to have them.
Yes, indeed.
And
indeed.
And there's hope, and in part because of what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
You understand that even though they're chronologically 20,
yeah.
for example,
yeah.
that their social and emotional capabilities are those of a typical 12-year-old.
Yeah.
And so what that means is you have the potential, if you meet them where they are, and I'm sure this is exactly what you guys did as they were growing up,
mm-hmm.
you met them where they were developmentally. You tried to provide developmentally appropriate opportunities for challenge and growth, and
yeah.
and progress was slow but steady.
Yes, it has been steady.
And okay. the most frustrating thing, I suspect, was that you would try to explain this to teachers, and yeah. to other people, and they'd look at you and shake, oh, poor you, you just don't understand. They need to live with the consequences of their behaviors, and you need to give them points and levels. And
yeah.
And that yeah. didn't work, did it?
Well, I will tell you that for the first, from the time that we got them until they went to high school, I homeschooled them.
Well, that's, and I think that that is actually in many ways probably why they did as well as they did.
Well, they have, I mean, they have some serious, serious issues transitioning here into adulthood. I mean, we've had, well, you just name it. There's all kinds of things that have happened that are not typical, of course, and right. compared to, and this is a very difficult situation, or it's a situation made harder by the fact that the three boys above them have transitioned into adulthood just fine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We've never made a transition very well with these three guys. It's always tougher. They're always behind.
Yeah.
Tammy, let me ask you, you started off the conversation saying that had we known.
Yeah.
What didn't you know? And when did you learn that you didn't know something?
Well, what we didn't know, for instance, when we adopted them, we never received any records of their growing up. We have no records whatsoever, no medical records, no records of their stay in foster care. We knew they were neglected from our social worker. And mom and dad left them alone at age 5, 4, and 3 and moved 11 times in 1 year to stay ahead of CPS. You know, always finding out these three little kids were crying and screaming and nobody's taking care of them kind of a thing. So we knew that they were left alone constantly. But honestly, in my own naiveness, I did not realize what neglect could do to someone's brain. I mean, I just didn't. I'm a physical therapist, and I understand these neurobiological things, but no one ever connected any dots for me that this neglect would be this serious.
And we really haven't.
And that I could interrupt and do something different than I did with my three older kids that would help them. And so now I find myself in this position. In our church, we have advocated adoption. I mean, our family has advocated adoption, and now I bet you there's 5 or 6 families that we know that have adopted these kids, more sibling groups like this. And their kids have the exact same behaviors ours did as little kids.
What do we know about the difference between neglect abuse mm-hmm. and physical abuse?
Well, neglect actually is, in many ways, more toxic. It's worse for the brain than an act of action like physical abuse or even sexual abuse, in part because it's the absence of a normal signal to make parts of the brain develop. And so areas in the brain either develop in a chaotic way or they don't develop at all. And the hardest thing is in many ways exactly what we're hearing, is that people just are completely unaware of what the kids are missing, what they need. They don't know enough about these core principles of neuroplasticity and neurodevelopment. And if, again, we hear this exact story time and time and time again. And if you would take an adoptive family and if you could give them this core content that we've been teaching all week and that, you know, has been taught to 2,000 professionals already in Franklin County, they would approach the work of parenting these children completely differently. And they would have made more progress more quickly. And I suspect that what happens is there's a lot of very attuned adoptive caregivers who slowly come to the conclusion that I need to do this. But that's a slower process than really understanding upfront what to do.
Jane White, as far as from where you're at Franklin County Family and Children First Council, is the philosophy behind this this lack of information? Has that historically been because they're afraid people won't adopt a child that is known to have so much trouble ahead and behind them?
You know, Anne, I think it's more that we didn't realize until recently the impact of knowing that information and understanding that if we all understood how that impacts the brain and therefore generates behaviors, we just didn't understand it mm-hmm. well before. And I think we'll see that change. I think we know that now.
Tammy, thanks a lot for your
call.
Our
social worker, I believe that's exactly right.
Okay.
When he presented these kids to us, his comment was, they've never been sexually abused. Mm-hmm. They've never been physically abused. They've only been neglected.
mm-hmm. Well, Tammy, thank you so much for thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it.
Sure. And can I just ask a question? How would I get that training you just talked about? Can I look on the website to figure that out?
Jane White?
We do have a website, Franklin County Family and Children First. If you Google it, you can go to our website. You can contact us anytime. We'd love to have you on our list so that the next time we have one of these conferences.
You mean anybody can
absolutely.
Go? Okay.
Absolutely. We would love to hear from you.
All right. Okay. Mary in Lancaster, you're on the air. Welcome, Mary.
Yeah. Hi. Look, I just wanted to ask the doctor his thoughts on maybe over-prescribing medication to children, maybe the influence of big pharmacies or, you know, the drug industry.
Yeah.
And also, a lot of times, teachers are making these diagnoses, whether they have attention deficit disorder, based on a child, like a checklist, when in fact it might be like reaction attachment disorder
okay.
or, you know, depression. Or trauma from the home.
Thanks, Mary. You've made the point that in some cases, medication might be the right thing to do, but the point is that we're just lumping a lot of kids together
right.
with certain behaviors.
Right. The caller made a couple of really important points. I mean, there's no doubt, and actually in the Institute of Medicine, which is the sort of the major academic credible body in the United States that regulates and provides information about medicine, had a white paper about the undue influence of, you know, pharmaceutical industries on the practice in psychiatry. And it's a major concern. In fact, the overprescription of medications for children in foster care is a huge problem. Far too many.
It's out of proportion.
It's way out of proportion to the level of symptoms. In fact, if you go into a child welfare setting in most states, the kids in child welfare are prescribed many, many, many more medications per child than the children who are actually in the mental health system, and which is just inappropriate. And so it's been a problem. The federal government's had here, you know, talked about it. There's the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry is trying to address it. It's a huge problem because what we do know is that medications, there's no medication on the planet that's going to build a new neural network. And if you've been neglected, you need new synapses. You need to learn new things. You need to build in new capabilities, and no medication can do that.
Can medication hurt the process of doing that?
Well, there is some evidence to suggest that it can. In fact, it's one of the major areas of concern that some of the important signals that stimulate growth in the brain are inhibited by certain of the medications that are widely prescribed. And so this is a problem for the field to grapple with. I do think that the emerging awareness of the principles of neuroplasticity, in other words, how do we actually specifically change the brain in ways that we want rather than universally, if you will, tone down the brain with a medication mm-hmm. so that we can get temporary diminishment of problem behaviors to make it easier to keep the kid in my class as opposed to actually teach the child a new concept.
And also always dependent on that and dependent right. on the fact that they'll even take the medication anyway.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, our field, broadly speaking, the field of child mental health is young. There are some exciting emerging concepts, but the bottom line is we have a lot to continue to learn, and the field of neuroscience is going to be really, really important in helping direct that growth.
Well, Dr. Bruce Perry, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about it. It's been fascinating.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
Dr. Bruce Perry, he's founder and senior fellow at the nonprofit Child Trauma Academy in Houston, and Jane Wide, executive director of the Franklin County Family and Children First Council. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Chaban, Julia Heider, Andrew Zissler, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky.